But first,
you didn't think twice. You threw me out, you're cold as ice. You gotta believe me, I was out of control. I'll never break the rules again, cause you're my only goal.
And let me tell you this, as bad as it sounds, you don't know the half of it until you watch the video. With more on that, we're joined by our friend Colin Fleming. Colin, thank you so much for inflicting that on my psyche.
Those glorious, open, ringing, Wagnerian chords do it for me every time. Great. It's orgastic, Kimball. That's how I
start. Wow.
Well, yeah, well, it's nice little segue there into our theme.
Now, what year was that?
Oh, that must have been... So this is the glory of the L.A. Kings, and they didn't have a lot of glory back then. This is when they wore purple and gold, and before Wayne Gretzky got there. So there wasn't a ton of glory. I almost made a joke. But there was a great line that the Kings had, one of the greatest lines in NHL history, a line that we can compare with the Bruins' top line of Marchand, Bergeron, and Pastrnak, and this was the so-called Triple Crown line, and Marcel Dion was the center, and you had Charlie Simmer and Dave Taylor on the wings, and they were all 100-point-a-year guys, and that was kind of the only thing the Kings had going for them. In 1982, that's when they knocked off the Wayne Gretzky-led Oilers with the so-called Miracle in Manchester. Is 5-0 in the third period. The Oilers are yucking it up on the bench. The Kings come back, and they win in overtime 6-5. It was great. But I believe this was the year before that. So we're getting 80s production values right at the root. They haven't, like, the flowers haven't sprung above the earth yet, but we're getting there. And you have this song, this video, that the Triple Crown guys, what would you even say? They act in? They appear in.
They appear in, yes. And I didn't know this. Apparently, the song was written by Alan Thicke.
Yeah. Isn't that awesome? I feel like that makes it a little more disturbing. And why are we saying it's disturbing, downtownians? Well, it's very pro, kind of pro-rape, frankly. It's kind of pro-sexual assault, but in this, oh, come on, baby. I knew I tried to push things a little too far last night, but let me out of the penalty box. Let's do it again.
Right.
Hey, I'm back out there. Drop that puck.
Forgive my misconduct, please. Wow.
Right. It's not a year-long suspension.
No.
It's not Knuckles Nylund has done it. He's just got into a dust-up.
Right.
And so they're out there, and Marcel Dion has always struck me as the kind of pervy guy. And in the video, it's funny because he's like, he looks like he's about 4'9" in the video, especially standing next to Charlie Simmer. And Charlie Simmer, one of those guys who was a great goal scorer. He was just hurt all the time, but he flirted with 50 goals in 50 games. New Englanders might remember him for his time with the Bruins when he was oft injured, but
he was
this compelling 1980s goal scorer. He got 50 goals more than once. And he looks really tall next to Marcel Dion. But Marcel Dion, he's into it. So they choreograph this. we're just using all these terms loosely for everyone who goes and checks this out. This isn't exactly like Nijinsky at the ballet. They go into the crease, Mario Lessard's crease, I might add. He was their star goalie that year, who completely fell apart the next year. Dion's in the middle, and the director, not exactly Orson Welles helming this, says, okay, the way we're going to do this dance is pretend someone's kind of in front of you and you're doing a lot of powerful thrusting. And Dion's like, oh, wow, I'm a method actor. That's all I need. And he really gets into Dave Taylor, who I actually spoke to once for a thing I was doing for ESPN. He looks like he doesn't want to be there. But Dion, he's having a good time. He's like Mephisto. He's like, finally, this hockey thing, if this doesn't work out, I can do my increased pelvic thrust, and I like this lyric. It's rich, it's sonorous, and it's just a very bizarre thing filmed. I wish I could say that, well, they did 2 weeks of shooting and then a week of reshoots, but no, somebody grabbed a video camera and a tripod, and they went out to centered iced out and did what they had to do. But it'll stick in your head that Alan Thicke, he was a tunesmith.
Oh, my. And you know what? The piece de resistance, the porn star mustaches.
Oh, yeah. But we shouldn't hold that too heavily against him, because a lot of people were sporting them back in that particular day. But it does. You have L.A., you have the whole porn industry. Maybe there was more of that vibe in the air. But it's like, I remember a few years ago, too, Marcel Dion was at some, like, award ceremony. Do you remember this? And he said something to Ellie Raceman. Now, I remember this because women say this to me in the Monument. And he said to Ellie Raceman, he said, "You have nice legs." And he got in all of this trouble for it. And I thought, huh, if they only knew this man's video history, they'd be able to connect those dots. Like, no wonder. He probably was thinking in his mind, come on, baby girl, forgive my misconduct.
5 minutes and I'm out of the box.
Right, I'm out of the box and I'm into the...
Oh no.
Sorry, buddy.
So, with great trepidation, I say, find this video online, and then please don't blame us for what we've done to you.
It'll get in your head, though.
Oh, yes.
It'll stay there. It's not as bad musically as... It's kind of like a bop country and western tune. It's enjoyable. I like it.
Musically, I would put it maybe slightly above the Super Bowl Shuffle.
There are worse sports-related music tunes out there, certainly. What really takes this to the level, well, I mean, besides the whole, like, transgressive, roofie type of theme, what really takes it to the level of just pure atrocity is the dancing and the shooting. And there is an empty rink, so it's kind of just, like, depressing, too. It's not like you'd want to call out extras to come to the rink to have you shoot this. But it starts there, and, like, they're in their bench, right? And they're, like, only two guys who've done misconduct. And then, like, Dave Taylor pops up. He was crouching down below. It's like, oh, wow, cleverness. Yeah, go check it out, people. You'll love it.
We're talking hockey with Colin Fleming this afternoon. And we're coming up this week on the 40th anniversary of one of the great moments in, I think, all of American sport, the Miracle on Ice.
I'd say that we could even extend that and say one of the great American moments, in that it transcends sports. And I think people have never really, I felt, gotten a great grasp on that team. It's talked about as the biggest upset in the history of sports. And I think that's limiting, because this team was stocked with talent. NHL, not just NHL talent, but star, all-star level NHL players. What's interesting to me about that squad is, and what I think is it's so much variance with life today, is they didn't know how good they were, and they went out and had no problem testing themselves. They risked finding out. They went for it. They didn't try to hang with this team. They tried to beat the bag out of this team that had just beaten the bag out of them to the tune of 10-3 at Madison Square Garden. It's the same month. It's not like it was 6 months before and now we've honed our game. They're like fresh off that thwacking. So to me, that's the thing that I feel like people should take away from this, because people are so conservative in the sense that they don't want to risk failure and they're not willing to put themselves out there. It's a form of, even though it's hockey, it's a form of vulnerability that I almost find touching. I find it inspiring in that regard, because you have to think about this team. There's some awfully good players on this team. It's like Neil Broden. Mark Johnson, he was a star for a while with the Whalers. Ken Morrow is going to, shortly thereafter, join the Islanders for their playoff run, and he's going to be on that team that wins the Stanley Cup against the Flyers. And he's going to be a rock in the NHL. And there were a lot of good players on this team. Jim Craig was not, he had some time in the NHL, but he didn't stick. But a lot of that, I feel like, was because he was this head case who decided to talk trash to the likes of Wayne Gretzky, and then Wayne Gretzky absolutely lit him up and embarrassed him, and I don't think he ever recovered from that.
And I think you could make the case that probably the two biggest names, the biggest personalities that emerged from that team were not at all the best pro prospects, Craig being one and Mike Arruzzioni the other.
Arruzzioni, yeah, I think that's overbuilt. I think the fact that he's made a career out of talking about that in the dinner circuit in really draining everything he can from that moment. There was a lot of other things that, to me, were a larger difference in that. They had a line, and Mark Pavlich was also on that line, the so-called fishing magician when he played with the Rangers because he was a big fishing guy. These are, okay, they're not Hall of Fame players, but these are guys who are like close to 100 points. Well, Brodin got over 100 points in the NHL. I mean, these are like really big time type of talent guys. These are Ruzioni was older, and this was going to be his final flourish, his final moment after playing at BU. But there was a lot of NHL talent on this team. And the thing about the Soviet team is they're in this in between period when this occurred, where you have guys from before like Harlamov, and he was there in the 72 Summit Series. And then the other guys coming up, your Fetisovs and Makarovs, players like that, who weren't really getting the notoriety and the ice time, that they were in a transition period. And it's interesting, too, because when we think about those Soviet players, when they come to the NHL, they don't really have the careers that we expect them to have based upon, you might have thought, from something like the 87 Canada Cup. Now, I don't know if that's because of when they got to the NHL, if it's because of the transition from one extreme form way of life to another, but these guys were also only like 30 or 31. So who knows really what that means, what the talent gap actually was. But Team USA, they went for it. And they said, okay, we might lose this game, but we can beat these guys. And they just put everything towards that. And I find that admirable because they could have been destroyed.
And also, it's a moment that probably wouldn't happen today because most people forget that what we saw here in America was not the live broadcast of that game.
Right. Yeah, I guess the wonders of Twitter would take care of that, and you'd have no need to actually tune in, and you just go and see who said something afterwards that was dumb, that was trending. But right, and there was this disclaimer that was put out at the time, saying, look, almost like a spoiler for like a Hitchcock film like Psycho. Hey, buddies, if you know what's happened out there, maybe don't go across the way and have a gansit with your neighbor and wreck it for him. Just keep this on the down low. And I don't think that took away anything from it. But to me, the big goal was the one where it's the end of the period and it's a dump in, and it shouldn't happen. Goals, if anyone plays hockey, as you know, goals that occur in the last minute of a period are just, they're crushing. They're not good for the hockey team's psyche. But a goal scored with like 1 second left, maybe it would be reversed on the replay these days. That was the one where I think if you were watching it live at the time, and I wasn't, I was just a pup, you'd say, huh, there is something that might actually happen here. And then they just took it to them. The Soviet team, they didn't pull their goalie. They were not used to being behind. I mean, they didn't believe in pulling the goalie. They didn't even believe in winning faceoffs. That wasn't important to them. And all of these kind of little things added up to this victory that would have, as Herb Brooks said, only happened once out of 100 times. But he said to the team, as everyone knows, this is your moment. So go out and make sure that you take it.
And it really rendered the gold medal game anticlimactic because people who didn't watch it live, a lot of people these days think that was the gold medal game, and it wasn't. They still had to beat Finland.
I don't know how that game, to me, it's just so misunderstood, that last game. And I think, like, okay, if I was watching this back then, I would have been a wreck for that gold medal game because they're losing in the game. And they're not losing, like, in the first minute. They're losing fairly late in the game. And I don't know, I guess maybe it'd be like if you were a Mets fan in 86 or a Reds fan in 75, where the Red Sox have that lead. In both of those game sevens, like, it's kind of late. It's not just they have a lead in the third inning. Like, if you're a Red Sox fan, you're watching this, you're thinking, oh, okay, this is going all right. I enjoy this. And you couldn't have felt that way if you were rooting for Team USA. In fact, the story, and it's not apocryphal, that Herb Brooks tells the team between periods is if you lose this game, you're going to take it to a not very nice word, your grave. And you probably get in trouble for saying something like that right now, and you would trigger somebody and violate their safe space. But I love that stuff. I loved all of the verbal abuse and all of that of hockey. I thought, like, this is wonderful. It makes you stronger because this is probably an inkling of what life is going to be like. So I ate that kind of stuff up. I wish I could coach a team and verbally abuse all the kids. No, that's wrong. But they imagine if they had lost that game, right? This would kind of be this weird footnote that we wouldn't know how to historically process.
We're talking hockey with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. And let's talk about the best goal scorer in hockey history. The answer seems obvious, but I'm guessing you're going in a different direction than Wayne Gretzky.
No, I'm going with Gretzky, but not for obvious reasons. And I've been thinking about this a lot, and there's a short list of guys. You have Mario Lemieux. You have Gordie Howe, who's a very underrated goal scorer. You have Phil Esposito, who's difficult to rank because he's on the Blackhawks, and he's pretty good, but he's not, like, lighting the lamp constantly. He goes to the Rangers after the Bruins, and he's pretty good again, but he's also older. He's racking up all of these goals when he plays with Orr, but if you actually go through the stat sheets, Bobby Orr and Phil Esposito are not combining on a lot of the goals. They were kind of producing separately. It was more like a Wayne Cashman thing with Phil Esposito feeding him.
Right. Well, that's why, you know, when I was thinking about it, and I thought, well, if it's not Gretzky, who might it be? And I went through people like Jagr and Howe. But for me, as a hockey fan, for those seasons when he was at his peak with the Bruins, there was no better goal scorer than Phil Esposito.
He just scored his goals in the same way every time. He was a slot machine. He cleaned up in the crease, and he had the relief, and he had the long reach before Mario Lemieux was there with his. But he wasn't busting down the wing and cutting in and flipping a backhander into the top of the net. It was always that same kind of idea. And I think his reputation has suffered because of Orr, but when Orr was injured, Esposito was producing at the same clip. And then he's further hindered by the fact that he leaves the league, and his records stand for, like, 2 years. Because of Gretzky. So I think really it comes down to me to three people. And one of them is Ovechkin. And just what he's doing, he might have the best shot in the history of the league. Not the hardest shot, but it must do something weird. Bend, something, dip, I don't know. Because he beats goalies more than anyone else ever has from far away. He doesn't score in close. It's weird that he's able to do it. Bossy was, in my view, a better version of Phil Esposito, who could score more ways, had the quickest release ever. But I think when we talk about, and he still has the highest goals per game average, that's partially because Lemieux came back. He was actually Sidney Crosby's teammate, and his average dipped a little bit. But Bossy scored 0.76 goals per game. I mean, that's like a 58-59 goal pace for his truncated career. But the thing that I demerit Ovechkin on is that he simply scores goals. He does nothing else. He's out there just to score goals.
That's right.
His entire focus. And with Gretzky, and I think Ovechkin will pass him. I think he's going to break that seemingly unbreakable mark. He was doing so many other things. And I think if Gretzky said, I just want to score the goal, enough of these assists. They're kind of flaky. Two people can get one for each goal. I'm not into that. I need to be the lone guy. I think that when we look at the best goal scorers, we have to factor in assists, which had never really occurred to me before. Like Gretzky, for instance, in 85-86, he decides he wants to get two assists a game, which is just abnormal. And he does. He gets 163 assists. The next year, and I think this is understated, he goes back to leading the league in goals with 62, as if to say, I can do this again if I wish. So I think if Wayne Gretzky was out there trying to be Alexander Ovechkin back in the day, I think you would have seen 100 goal seasons from him. As it is, he had 92. He had 87 in the season when he was pacing at a higher rate. And I don't know how you do this. He had 50 goals in 39 games, which seems obscene to me.
Well, and he has, for his career, 800 more assists than the next guy on the list.
The other day I was doing a little research and I saw that, I'll get the numbers a little bit off right now, but it was something like on January 7th of the 1983-84 season. So January 7th, 1984, it's like the Oilers' 41st game of the season. If Wayne Gretzky had just said, I've had enough of the regular season, boys, I will sit this out. I've played 41 games. he would have won the scoring title. I don't like that. That's not even like video. It's just, it's not people like, who's the best composer? Is it Bach? Is it Beethoven? Is it Mozart? You can kind of like, it's going to go, it's probably Bach, but it's, that's an argument. This is not an argument. And what people want to argue against Gretzky with is goalies. If you watch any clip on YouTube, do it after you look up the song, you'll see so much net. It's like, wow, what is this? This is completely, it's like, usually now there's a Transformer dude in the net, like Megatron's in the net. And back then there was so much space, but he's outscoring guys. Mike Bossy's putting up 61 goals, and he's not even in Gretzky's neighborhood. And Jari Kari is getting 71, but Gretzky's feeding him the puck for like 60 of them. So to me, even though his mark is going to get surpassed, he had 950 goal seasons. And in the season when he had the 87 goals, he was on a better pace than the season when he had the 92. I've noticed this strange kind of anti-Gretzky stance lately with Ovechkin. He wouldn't do this in the league. But again, we've talked about him before. Okay, 1 year a guy had 108 points, was second. And Gretzky had 183 points. So it's like, you can get, somebody's going to have 108 points. Brad Marchand might get up. Pasternak might get around 108 points. It's doable, but nobody's going to have 183.
Some great hockey insight, as always. Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Colin, we thank you, and we'll catch up with you again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.